Hi, my name is Marsha Altman, and I'm the author of The Darcys and the Bingleys, and I'm here to discuss the third book in my series, which is called Mr. Darcy's Great Escape. If you haven't read or checked out the podcast for The Darcys and the Bingleys, or the second book, The Plight of the Darcy Brothers, you should probably go to marshaaltman.com and do that, because I'm going to be talking about the third book in a series, and you're not going to know what's going on at this point. So, feel free to check those other podcasts out, or feel free to check the books out, because the books are, more comprehensive than the podcast talking about the books. Anyway, as usual, the first part, which will be much shorter, will be about the book for readers who have not read the book, and the second part, which will be much longer, probably, I have a lot to say about this book, will be for people who have read it and will be full of spoilers. Anyway, part one. For you, those of you who have not read it but have read the previous two books, of which I'm just assuming at this point I have to go on that assumption, the third book is the axis on which the series turns. The third book was, I had grown in confidence after I wrote books one and two. First two short stories, and then book two, which was my first novel-length attack of the text. And I really wanted to do something major for book three. And book three is major. A lot of things go on. There's a lot of subplots and regular plots. The adult generation, which I'm now referring to them more and more because eventually I'm going to be referring to the children's generation when they're old enough to be characters. The adult generation goes through a lot. In fact, there's actually a bit of fallout so that the climax of the adventure part of the story happens well before the end because there are results from the adventure part of the story, the actual escape, so to speak, though it is actually an escape. That what happened when I first posted this on fanfiction.net, this was many years ago, I wrote it, I posted it as I was writing it, and I didn't really know what I was getting into. And when I finished it, I said, wow, that was really long and really hard to do. I'm going to make the next ones shorter. I'm not going to do this story, which at the time was called Left to Follow, ever again. Needless to say, I do approach the length of this story in future books, but it takes like four books to get there. Books four, five, six, and I believe seven are all back to normal book length. Book six is actually pretty short. It's the shortest by far. And then when I get to the final books, I just have a lot to do again. This is also the book that people got really serious about my series at this book. This is the book where I started getting a lot of comments and feedback, and a lot of people saying, I will read anything you write. And it seems to be that people are in two camps. They will either love this book and stay with me until book 10 and read everything that I write. Or they will hate this book and put the series down and never touch it again. Then you're, when you read the book, you'll be become one of those two people. It's the darkest book of the series. Dark book things happen in other books, but this is by far the darkest book, even though there is a lot of levity, I think. And I changed publishers after this book. So, this was it was an editorially difficult book. It was the hardest book to write. It was the hardest book to edit. It was the hardest book to publish so far in the last bit. And I'm really proud of it, despite some of the flaws that I think are in it, looking back on it now after years have after having written it. It's just a major accomplishment in the series. Anyway, so the plot line of this book, without giving away a tremendous amount. At first, there's a small Lady Catherine plot line. We haven't seen her in a while because we find out that Darcy has not spoken to her since he married Elizabeth because of her refusal to accept Elizabeth as his wife. And she throws out a peace offering to him, and he brings his brother, Gregoire, along, who's still a monk. And there are some revelations there. And Colonel Fitzwilliam and Anne de Burgh, who are now married, and Colonel Fitzwilliam becomes Lord Matlock over the course of the book, thanks to the death of his brother. This is the only book where they have any prominence. I don't use them much after this book. I just have two big a cast and I'm not always interested in using everybody. This is also the only book. This is the book where Kitty gets married, very, very briefly. So this is her big spotlight as well, because I really am not a huge Kitty fan. I kind of view her as the skim milk version of Lydia. She's kind of watery and doesn't taste as good. That's a bad analogy when I spelled it out, but I didn't have much to do with her. Anyway, after the Lady Catherine plot line, some time passes and it's 1812, and Napoleon is famously invading Russia and learning that you should never invade Russia from land. It's going to be a disastrous campaign that is going to, end his reign temporarily in France, but at this point he's conquered most of Western Europe. England is kind of the holdout. They're in a major state of war, even though none of the characters are at war. And no one knows yet that if Napoleon's going to be a failure or a success, because so far he's been a major success, conquering everything in sight. He's taking control of pretty much all of Europe in about a decade, so that's really impressive. And over the course of time, Dr. Maddox's brother, Brian, who in the previous book attempted to redeem himself, sort of goes missing, or has been missing for some time, but Dr. Maddox didn't know about it because he didn't have any information to confirm whether his brother was missing or not. And at the same time, Darcy's brother, Gregoire, who's in an Austrian monastery, also goes missing. And Darcy can't confirm, as Napoleon's troops are passing through, what happened to his brother. So Dr. Maddox and Darcy decide to travel together because there's safety in numbers, and Darcy doesn't speak German. Dr. Maddox does. They travel together in Europe, intending to split up when they get where they're going. And that is not what happens to them. From the word escape, you can guess that they somehow wind up in a captive situation and need to be rescued by their wives, pretty much. I mean, there are men involved, but it's pretty much their wives. It's kind of like Elizabeth's big hurrah. And then that group that was res the rescuers need to be rescued again, because this is a very messed up time to be traveling around Europe, especially if you look rich. And when they get back, I'm not going to give away whether there are any deaths or not, but the people who do get back are really, they have to deal with what happened and deal with the effects of war. And through that, they are transformed into a much closer family, but also a family that has scars that things have happened to. I am giving away very non-specific things, but this is the moment where I really establish that these characters are these characters, and this is the events of this book shape them and how they are in the rest of the books. It's always kind of lurking in the background. It's brought up again in a much later book in a major way, and it's very traumatizing. It's fun for the readers, it's not fun for them. And there's a fun subplot line that involves Japan. This is the book with the most spoken languages. I got people to translate French, German, Romanian, and Japanese for this book. There's dialogue in all of those, which is then translated. This is the first book with samurai in it. It took me three books to work up to that. It's also the only book with Jews in it, because I just didn't want to throw in Jews in Regency England for the sake of there being Jews in my books. I mean, there were Jews in Regency England, there was just no reason for my characters to interact with them, and I wanted to throw some Jews in, so I did. I threw in a very famous Jew, the Alter Rebbe, the author of the Tanya. If you don't know who that is, it's explained. There's a biography in the back of the book. And I hope that you will enjoy it. I hope you will follow me through the whole ride. I actually don't know anyone who has thrown this book down midway through and said, "It's too dark." Oh, I do know one person, but she was an editor. But, this book is massive in what it is trying to do, and I hope you will appreciate, everything that I'm trying to do at this point. I didn't know was setting up for the rest of the series when I wrote it. I just wrote it because I felt that's naturally what happened, and then it became defining. And as a result, I'm proud of it. And that said, I would never go through writing it again, because at the time that I wrote it, it seemed really, really long in a writing kind of way. In a reading kind of way, you get a lot of bang for your buck. with this book. This is why this book has cost a dollar more than the previous two books. There is a ton of material, and then there's some material in the appendix explaining some things. And honestly, I would have just gone on and on in that appendix if I could have or thought to do so. I got better in book four about adding things in the appendix that could be important. So I really, really hope you will check this book out, either online or in a bookstore or from a book that you got online or on your reader if you have a reader. I'm not a big fan of those, but a lot of people have them. So however you check out this book, I really, really hope that you enjoy it. And I hope that you continue with the rest of the series. If you're sold on this book, you will be sold on the entire series for sure. Thanks a lot for listening. Anyway, part two. This part is for people who have read the book. Okay, I'm just not going to go through the particular details of the book. I'm just going to, as people suspect, I have a lot to say about this book. This book was a major editing battle for me. There's no better word than I can use than battle. What happened with this book, I really first want to say, I have a good relationship with Sourcebooks, I think. I have a great relationship with the editor who acquired this book. We're friends. She's very, very nice. And I enjoy talking to her, on a personal basis when I get a chance. She's an editor, so she's very busy. And she did stand up for me. But I knew this book. I sensed it was going to be a problem. It was bought in a package with book two, and they didn't really take a close look at it until it was time to go edit it for publication because they had bought it in a package and they kind of assumed that I kept the same tone of the previous two books, which is usually a good assumption for an author. Anyway, we got to editing the book, and how do I put this? Sourcebooks and I had very, very different definitions for what the book should be, different visions for what the book should be. Unfortunately, the book was already written, and so were pretty much all the other books after it. I must have been working on book nine when this came out, or somewhere in that region of book nine or book ten. And events were pretty much settled in my mind because they were referred to in later things, so there was only so much I could change or wanted to change. I knew that some things had to be changed. I knew that the torture scene, which as a, from a writer's perspective, I'm very proud of when Dr. Maddox learns about electricity by being tortured by Trommler. I knew that that was going to be cut. Just going into the, I just kept it in there because I thought maybe they will not want to cut it, but it was cut. And Sourcebooks really felt that my audience wanted something lighter, and I tried to meet them halfway with several revisions, which were agonizing to do. And I decided that I hated all of the revisions, that they took the punch out of the book. And this is a major, major book for punching Darcy, somewhat literally and not literally. He is traumatized by the events of this book. His relationship with Elizabeth becomes, impossibly deep as a result of what they go through in this book. Dr. Maddox doesn't change his personality, but he also goes through a lot in this book, and I didn't want to cheapen it, and I didn't want to change it. And I knew this was an impact book. I also knew that my readers, the ones who stayed with me in the whole series, loved this book, and I was ready. I went in ready to fight. Editing is a process which is very, very, very difficult for everyone just because it's time-consuming, where first the editor who acquired your book or another person in the office edits the book and sends you notes and tells you to go through it again. And sometimes you don't have to do it page by page, but usually you have to do it page by page, depending on how many issues there are. And these are dealing with issues in the plot, as well as some grammatical stuff. When you both agree on that, it then goes to copy editing, which is the line by line thing, looking for grammatical errors and inconsistencies, and you will have to approve changes on every single page of the book. So you will see every single page of the book multiple times in the editing process to the point where you will hate yourself, the book, the universe, the publisher, your computer screen, just everything you will want to just set on fire to make you not have to read it again. This is true with every book that I've ever written, had published, is it, that's the editing process. It's just something you have to go through. But you also have to pick your battles because when the editor gives suggestions, that's because they're a publishing professional and they would like your book to be as good as, to be as good as possible, to make as many readers happy as possible, and to sell as well as possible. So these suggestions are not invalid. Your book didn't go in perfect, and hopefully it will come out better at the end of the editing process. That's the reason for the editing process. So a lot of things I just agree with in the editing process. The editor comes up with suggestions to make things better or points out mistakes, and I'm like, thank you, because, and then I agree to those things. And then there's things in the middle that I could kind of take or leave. And as an author, I really always want to get along with my editors. And the things to take or leave, I tend to side with them. If they say, just, I don't think this line works, and I think the line works fine, but I don't really care either way whether it gets into the book at that point. I'm too exhausted, and I don't think it's a major issue. I just usually say, fine, delete it. Let's not think about it anymore. And because I'm kind of saving up stamina for the things that I'm going to have to fight for. And that happens in every book. At some point, you're going to hit a scene or a plot line or something where you're going to have to put your foot down and say, no, I want this in, either because I did all the historical research and I know that it's correct, or I did all the historical research and I know that I can get away with it, or it's just too central to the book for me to remove it. And hopefully it doesn't get, really, really complicated. But in this book, obviously, it did. Because Sourcebooks wanted a much lighter book, and I couldn't do that. And at some point in the editing process, I said, look, this is the book I wrote. I'm willing to make every small change that you guys want, but the major changes that you want, I can't do. I just can't do them. And it's going to be my way or the highway, which is at that point, the contract stipulates that you and the publisher must agree on the final version of the book. So, in an extreme example, if for whatever reason you and the publisher cannot agree on a final version, which very rarely happens in publishing, it's usually there for when the publisher buys a book from an author, and then the author 6 months later comes back with a complete revision that makes the book entirely different and not the book that the publisher bought. That's usually when that occurs, that they go to that clause and they say, okay, should we break contract and not have the book published? And that was actually a point of discussion between us, and my agent was involved. I kind of felt that if this book didn't go the way that it was, this rest of the series just couldn't happen. And I knew that I was going to fight uphill in every book afterwards for every serious scene if I kept this book light and silly, and I couldn't do that. It just, there's no reason to publish the series at that point. It's not my work. And Sourcebooks really felt that they wanted to give the readers what they had seen before, which is a funny, book one is very, very jokey. It's kind of a laugh out loud book. Book two is more serious, but still kind of maintains that. And they wanted the readers to get what they thought they were getting. When you buy from the same author, you hope to get something similar to what the author previously wrote. That's why you're buying the same author. If I buy Stephen King's a bad example. He writes a lot of things. But if I buy Isaac Asimov book, I read it and enjoy it. And I buy another book that's in the same series that he was writing, like the Foundation series or something, I expect it to be similar to the previous book. I expect the same tone and characters and things like that. That is why I am buying it. So Sourcebooks had a very, very valid point. But it did come to that. It did come to the point of us saying, we have no middle ground here. What do we do? And then I said, look, this is the book that I want to be published. I put my name behind it. If this is the last book I ever publish, then fine. And Sourcebooks stepped up and said, all right, this is what you want to do. You're the author. You know what's best for the series. We agree to that. I wasn't bluffing either. And we totally repaired, we didn't. It hadn't destroyed our relationship. It had just been a very, very exhausting process. And obviously, authors take everything to heart. We try not to, but we do. So for me, it was a very, very emotional process. I'm sure it was an emotional process on their end as well. But, I cried a lot during this editing process. Not because of mean things they said to me, but just because it was so difficult and the text got so personal that I really want to say they were really nice to me the entire time and meant best and wanted this book to be the best book it could be. We just didn't agree on what the best book it could be was actually, what was actually the content of that book. And in the end, they went with my decision and we didn't break contract and we published the book and it did well. I don't know if it would have done better if I did their version, but that's irrelevant. And I really just want to take a moment to thank Sourcebooks for going through with that because that was a risk for them. I was going off the track of what I had done in the previous two books, and they didn't know as if as a result it would sell or not, and it did sell. And I want to thank my readers for buying it. But man, I did plead with so many people to buy that book. I hadn't done it with the previous two books. I had been kind of calm about it. But this book, I just said, please, for the love of God, buy the book. I don't care if you use it for kindling. I don't care if you use it for a doorstop. I don't care if you use it for toilet paper. Just please buy this book. And as a result, a lot of people did come out and buy it, but also people just bought it because it was the next book and they wanted it. So I really just am very, very grateful to Sourcebooks despite the agonizing battle that occurred. Maybe I shouldn't use the word battle, but that's really what it felt like. In battle, we're both, you want your side to win, but you kind of want the other side to agree with you and win too. So thank you, Sourcebooks, is how I'm ending this part of the thing. As a result of all of this, there are more changes to this book than in any previous book, and I think will be in any book unless we hit a major issue with future book. And anyway, so most people when they read the stories online and they read the books, they're basically getting slightly improved versions of the stories online, better copy edited versions of the stories online. Not a whole lot has changed. In this book, the main plot points are all there, but there have been some changes. The biggest changes are in obviously Darcy and Dr. Maddox's imprisonment in Romania, which is called Austria, but the noblemen are called Hungarian. And this is because it was what it said in books. I found out that Romanian noblemen in the Austrian Empire thought of themselves as Hungarian, so suddenly Princess Nadi, who was always an Austrian princess because people didn't know where Romania was or didn't know where Transylvania was. She was always an Austrian princess in the original series, and then she became Hungarian when I did research for this book. Obviously, the torture scene was removed, and some others were kind of cut down, and I had to kind of add some sort of humor. And so at the time, I was also working on a book called The Aristotle Vampire, which is unrelated, but I was hoping to get published traditionally, and so far that hasn't happened. Hopefully, in the future, I'll write a better version and it'll be published. So, I added two characters to kind of get them out of their situation, one of whom is named Artemy, or Artemis, and the other is named Yangi. And the book kind of hints, but doesn't outright say, that they are actually vampires. Because in the big scene where they're trying to trick the Count into believing that, there's an evil witch played by Caroline who has put a curse on him, and that's why he doesn't have children. And Gregoire is dressed up like a werewolf. Trommler brings out this giant cross, and everyone pretends to be, intimidated by the giant cross. Well, Artemis, because Aristotle has gone through, using other names in his life, and Yangi are actually cringing for real. Because they are actually vampires who are con artists who are conning this count so that they can live there and get his money. Aristotle is actually the Aristotle from history, and though he, in his the, I at last minute I changed his name to Artemis just to avoid some copyright issues that might have come up, but it is the same character. And Yangi, who is half Uyghur, which is Chinese Muslim, and half Tibetan, is also a vampire, a much younger vampire. And at some point in Aristotle Vampire, the book, he does mention that he traveled around Eastern Europe with Yangi and tricking noblemen into giving them his money by telling fortunes. And mentions that specifically in Aristotle Vampire, A, because it happened, and B, because I wanted to reference this book. So I'm really kind of proud of that, just on a personal level. That character means a lot to me. So that was put in. kind of just to satisfy the whole this is too dark. I don't think they made it that much lighter, but it gave new material to the book, which made source books happy, so that's what I did. Other than that, not a whole lot else was changed, but there are new scenes with those two characters who are not previously in the book. What else was done? Lady Catherine's death was cut. It now occurs off screen and is not mentioned in the book, and I forgot to mention it in book four. I don't know when I'll get around to mentioning it. The reason for that, despite her having a actually kind of ideal death for her, dying quietly at home, surrounded by her children and grandchildren, Gringoire, whom she ends up, loving platonically as an awesome guy, because he is, and he performs miracles. That was cut because at that point in the storyline, no, at that point in the editing process, we had gone through so much and argued so much over the Austrian scenes. It's not really Austria, it's Romania. Romania, though, is not independent. It won't be independent for a long time. So I think post-World War I, it became an independent country. So, I had fought so hard, and at that point, I was really, it wasn't that I was giving in, it's just that I had to give a lot of ground. And she said, cut Lady Catherine's death. I don't want any more death in this book, despite there actually being very little death in the book. And I said, sure. Yes, I agree to those cuts. Yes, I just put up my hands and said yes. It wasn't really an important scene to me, even though it is a significant scene to the characters, but the characters are fake and I made them up. So, except for the Jane Austen characters that I didn't make up, but they're fake. They don't need to be on screen all the time. So that was cut. I think Bingley's leg injury was lowered to like a sprained ankle or some shit, I don't know. Or there was a request for it to be lowered. At first, it was a request for him to be lowered to not injured, because we were trying to cut down on the violent content of the book. And I said, no, because that's a climactic scene for the introduction of Mugen into the story and the return of Brian and Noddy, and him being injured introduces Mugen to Georgiana, which becomes one of the most important relationships, definitely the most important non-marriage relationship in the entire series. He has to be injured, I'm sorry. And they said okay, I think because they were tired of arguing about this too, but I think I made it sprained instead of, I don't know what eventually we came out with, but there was some discussion there. Even though that his injury is a very, very minor point. It just keeps him away from Darcy for a while Darcy's going through all these traumatic things. Bingley isn't there to help him because Bingley is laid up. And Darcy's laid up too in his own way. And what else was okay, so the one major change that I agreed to do at the time, and my agent agreed with me that this was a good change, but in the end I don't think worked for the book. If I got a chance to do a second edition, I would change it, is that I cut up segments where Brian it tells the story of where he was. I'm very proud of those segments. I really didn't know if people were going to read them and care about them when I posted them on fanfiction.net. They were just two long chapters which occurred right, together at some point. I don't remember what exact point, but it's, after he shows up in England. There's just two long chapters that explain where he was. But I ended up really, really enjoying writing it and really enjoying how the text came out, because it was a little different than the rest of the text. It's much less talky, it's more telly. There's much less dialogue because I have to get through a lot of stuff at once. And it's the introduction of both Ainu and Japanese culture. Ainu, by the way, are the indigenous people of Japan who were there before the Japanese invaded, and they live in the north, and at this period in time they were very persecuted. So I felt proud putting them in and doing research on that. And the suggestion from Sourcebooks was break it up over four parts, we ended up doing, I think. I don't remember whether it was three or four, but it was something like that. And break them up so that we're not away from Darcy for too long. Darcy is the reason that people read these books, so that was their philosophy. And I asked my agent, because she was well read in this book at this point, what do you think? And she said, sounds like a good idea to me. And that was done. And when my mom read it, usually I don't rely on my mom doesn't see the book until it's published. She's just another reader who is also my mom. My grandmother also reads the books, but not until they're published. My mom is not a writer. She's a very wonderful woman, but she's not a writer, so she's not involved at all in this process. I don't ask her to review the book before I send it out for publication. She generally doesn't see things at all unless they get published. So my mom said, that really broke up the story and made it hard to follow because a lot is going on in the Brian story, and then we cut back to England, then we cut back to Brian. And pretty much everyone who I've spoken to about these segments has said that, wow, it really breaks up those segments and makes them hard to follow. And I'm sure it lessens their impact, or at least that's my opinion of it. And I'm like, well, things had to happen. You had to pick your battles. This wasn't a battle I could fight. I really had to agree to stuff at this point in the editorial process, and I didn't think it was going to be that big of a deal, so they got caught up. Honestly, if you want to read them, you can go online to my website. The whole series is available. You can read the original versions, where it's just two long chapters. Tale of Brian Mannix, I think part one and part two are just, next to each other. You just read them. But yeah, if I had to change one thing in this book, I pretty much the only thing I would change at this point, I would go back and put them back together as one long segment. I think it works better that way. But things happen in publishing, not everything comes out perfect. People don't see that. They get a book and they think, wow, this is must be the perfect version of this story, the only way it could have been told. And really, the book is a result of a long process of writing and editing and self-editing and showing it to friends, sending it to your agent, sending it to the publisher, having the publisher edit it. Just there's been a lot of hands in the stew, and not everything comes out right as a result, or because I'm not a good enough writer, whatever reason. Sometimes, it's on my end. So that got caught up, and that lessened the impact of that, and I'm not thrilled about that. But I would change that if I could. But it doesn't ruin the book. Okay, so I have some assorted things to say about this book, if you're still listening. Oh, this was a funny part of editing. At some point, I don't know who it was. I don't even think it was Sourcebooks. I think it might have been Brandy. Wanted to change the dialogue that Mugen had. And Mugen, the problem was that Mugen's dialogue was in Japanese. I had several years before sent the dialogue I wanted him to say to someone who knew Japanese, who then translated it back to me, and provided me with a kind of translation of what he said, because some of the things that I, the original dialogue I had written wasn't necessarily translated well into Japanese. So she sent it back, and I put it in the book. And someone at some point said to me, you got to change what he says. And I, the translation of what he says. And I said, I can't do that because I can't change. The translation line comes right after the line of Japanese dialogue. And it's just there to provide the readers with help as to what he's saying. I said, no, because it wouldn't line up with the Japanese. I can't change the Japanese. I don't know Japanese. And I don't know someone who can translate it this fast. That person who did that, very grateful to her, but it took her a long time to do the translation. For whatever reason, she has a lot going on in her life. And at this exact moment, I don't have anyone around me who speaks Japanese who can change the line. So no, I can't change the line. And we went back and forth for a while, and I was trying to explain this. No, I cannot change the translation of the line to anything else. It has to be that line because I have this Japanese text that I myself cannot understand, and I have the translation of it as given to me by the person who wrote it. And that's it. It stays that way. No argument. That was kind of funny. Also, I'm very proud of this book, putting a Jew in. Basically, what happened was I knew that the Hasidic movement was kind of being born. It wasn't being born, it was in like its toddlerhood. It hadn't split up into a ton of different sects yet, but I knew that the Baal Shem Tov, who founded it, was dead. And I looked up who was alive in 1811, which is when Brian and Nadi were crossing through Russia. So I just looked up who was alive in Russia in 1811, and I got Rabbi Zalman of Leiadi, who is the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad Lubavitch, which at this point had not acquired the name Lubavitch. Most Hasidic sects are named after the town in which they were founded. So there is a town in Russia called Lubavitch, and after his death, most of his followers moved there and continued the movement from there. He actually called the movement Chabad, which is a Hebrew acronym for what I don't know. And they moved to the town of Lubavitch, so it became called Chabad-Lubavitch, or you can refer to people who are Chabad-Lubavitch as Chabadniks or Lubavitchers. Similarly, the Satmar, who are the largest Hasidic group, are from the town of Satmar, which is in, I believe, the Ukraine. They're not from there anymore, but they used before World War II, that's where they were, that's where they were based. That's the case with most Hasidic groups, is that they are named after the place where they got started. So I had a lot of Lubavitcher friends, and I had actually read the Tanya, which is a mystical book, or I'd read parts of the Tanya. It's a mystical book that was written by Rabbi Zalman and is very, very highly respected, obviously, by the Chabadniks. They study it a lot. It's very easy to. I studied it in college with a Lubavitcher friend. And by the way, they're the guys who stand on corners and ask you if you're a man, if you're Jewish, do you want a light tefillin? And if you're a woman, do you need Shabbos candles? Because they do a lot of outreach. So if you know any Hasidim, you probably know Lubavitchers. They're Hasidim that you know are probably Lubavitchers. They are like the second or third biggest Hasidic group, mostly because they're Russian. And a lot of the Hasidic groups that were in Poland got totally wiped out in the Holocaust, like every member killed. Or like a couple members weren't killed, and then they moved to America and became part of a joined another group so that they could have other people to marry who are also Hasidim. They usually join Satmar, which is why Satmar is so large. But Lubavitch were in Russia and escaped World War II, though they were very, very persecuted first by the Tsar and then by the communists. So I was really, really happy to put the Alter Rebbe in. I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. Person. He died the following year, the year after Brian and Nadi were there. And my Lubavitch friends were just utterly thrilled that I had done this. They just couldn't believe that I had done this. So, and there is a funny story about Napoleon and Rav Zalman, which is not true. There's basically one English biography of him, and it was done by the Lubavitch movement for Lubavitcher children. So, A, it's a children's book, it's a young adult book in terms of complexity, and B, by people who kind of semi-worship what he wrote. So, it's not like a fact-digging expose. It's the stories we have about him. One of the stories they had was that he stopped Napoleon's invasion of Russia. I shit you not, the book says this. The way that he did it was that Napoleon was like invading and had lodged his horses in a barn, and the Rebbe used his mystic Torah power to turn the to make barn burned down, like it just went on fire and burned down, and Napoleon was so spooked by it that he turned around and went back to Europe. That was just hilarious. In actuality, Napoleon was nowhere near Leadi. There was no chance. He came after Rav Zalman died, and no, actually, I think there was some crossover period between when Rav Zalman died and Napoleon was in Russia, but he was nowhere near Leadi, and he did not turn around as a result of a barn fire. He turned around because his men were freezing to death. So yeah, that is not that. That was really, really funny. I just couldn't believe that that was actually in the book. The actual story. Yeah, if you're still listening, just enjoy it for what I have to say about this. The actual story is that the Hasidic movements of Russia had a lot of financial connections to the current aristocracy, and they didn't think it would be great if Napoleon invaded, because he would shake that up, and they didn't really know much about him, so they sided with the Tsar, despite the fact that all of the Tsars had basically persecuted them, and it didn't look like that was going to change, though actually it got worse after this period. So the Cossacks, who kind of worked for the Tsar, are the reason that my grandparents left Russia, because they were getting sick of it being attacked by Cossacks. So, that's how I feel about the Tsar. But this is a different Tsar. So they sided with the Tsar, even though they had no major contribution militarily or financially to the actual combat, but they all sided with him politically. They had no part in the political process as Jews, but that's just the way that they felt. And in actuality, Europe would be a tremendously different place if Napoleon had successfully conquered Russia. It probably would be a far more Jew-friendly place if Napoleon had successfully conquered Russia, because Napoleon kind of really opened the doors in Europe, the places he did conquer, for Jews to join normal society. This is about the time that Jews started taking last names, because they had more contact with Gentiles, and the Gentiles had last names. And they had always gone by blank son of blank, and now they suddenly needed last names, so they took last names that had to do with what trade they were in. So you have a lot of Goldman, Silverman, Goldsmith. My name, my real last name is Mormon. I don't know what a Moor is, but it's not Mormon like the religion. It's Mormon with an A, so like all the other Jewish names. It might have originally been Meerman, actually, and it was changed at some point. So Napoleon did a lot for the Jews and had a great deal of respect for them. And had he conquered Russia, the Jews in Russia would not probably have been so heavily persecuted in the future as they were by the future czars. So it was really not in the Jews' benefit to not support him, but even if they could have. But and they also viewed his process of assimilation of not saying Jews shouldn't be Jewish, but saying that everyone should be part of society. And a lot of Jews or Jewish leaders felt we are not part of Christian society, and we also shouldn't be, because we'll just occult, we'll assimilate and marry Christians and stop being Jewish. So we should live on our own and have nothing to do with the Christian people who don't like us anyway. So they didn't want to be, some of them didn't want to be citizens. They didn't want to have all those responsibilities of being part of civic life. They wanted to be separate and preserve their separate culture. And Napoleon was a threat to that. They didn't actually have any impact at all on the war, but that's the way that when they came out with discussions about, oh, Napoleon's advancing armies, they were like, oh no, the Tsar must protect us. Like, totally ridiculous. The reason that Rav Zalman gave was he felt that there should be a czar and not a democratically elected government, despite the fact that Napoleon was not democratic. He had just declared himself emperor, because man must know what it's like to serve a master, otherwise he won't understand what it's like to serve God, who is the ultimate, king of kings, which is really tricky logic. It's just a cover for the political things that were going on in the Hasidic movement at the time, and also the Misnagdim, which are the posers, the black hat guys who are not Hasidic. Everyone thinks that Jews walking around with black hats and black coats are Hasidic. No, a lot of them are Misnagdim, who are a lot like Hasidim, but the cultural differences are, I could go into that for a while, but that's not what I'm talking about here, even though it has turned into what I'm talking about here. So yeah, I was really happy that that got in. I didn't think it was going to be cut. I was really happy all the samurai stuff got in, including the fact that Mugen, obviously one of the most important characters in the series, my personal fan favorite character, who may or may not have been inspired by some anime, got in. I did a tremendous amount of research for the Japanese segments. I would do even more in the future, and I think I did some revision of the Japanese segments just because I knew more. But when I did the whole Brian segment in this book, but I don't think there was a ton that was changed because I really did look up stuff. The fact that Mugen was bi, source books had no problem with. Not that they are against homosexuals, it's just weird to show up in a Regency period book. So, but they had no comment on that. They said, fine, whatever you're doing, we don't really, know what you're doing here. This segment, sure, whatever happens, happen. I cheated a lot with research for Transylvania at the time period. I really couldn't find a lot because not a lot was going on. They were part of the Austrian Empire. They were eventually going to become part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And there isn't a lot written about them in the mid-1800s because in the 1840s there was an unsuccessful attempt to become independent. There was some uprisings about that. But in the early 1800s, there's really very, very little material about that area. And I was exploiting, local lores and legends. The fact that the count who, and the princess, who shouldn't really be a princess, she's not the daughter of a king, but whatever, speak Romanian is itself very strange because they would have spoken Austrian or Hungarian or something else. They probably wouldn't have spoken the language of the peasants. But in the original version, I had her speak that, and I didn't feel like changing it. It just makes it a language that is just more impenetrable. The only two people who speak Romanian in the series are Brian and Nadi, and that's kind of, they know Japanese, but that's the language they revert to when they don't want anyone to know what they are saying but want to talk in front of people. I don't think there's any actual custom for Romanian women covering their hair. I just threw that in because I had looked at some pictures of women from that time, and women who were photographed in traditional dress and their hair was all covered. Whatever. Maybe Nadi just does it because it's her personal thing. It's not a major Romanian custom that I could find. Really, I flubbed some stuff, or I just kind of sailed through and said, no one's going to question this after all the stuff that's happened in this book. This was the first book that I did major research for during, not before, but during. I did look stuff up, and I did get horribly misled into thinking that the Bavarian saint Sebaldus was actually from England. He was actually a Saxon, but he was not from England. He lived early enough that the Saxons were still in Europe, or something like that. Like, I had to, went to some very misleading websites that had incorrect information, and I jumped on it, and that's why he's returned to England, even though he was really from Europe. Like, he was from the mainland. That was just outright wrong. I put it in the, and I found out that you could get a hit, sort of get out of jail free card for the series if you just put at the back of the book all of the things that you intentionally changed or made mistakes about, like that there are wolves in England. Oh shit, I made that a major motif, and then somewhere around book eight, someone mentioned to me that wolves are extinct in England and had been for hundreds of years. Fuck, what am I supposed to do about that? Because I had seen someone else do this in another book that was also a Pride and Prejudice sequel. I won't name the book, but in the book, there's one major historical gaffe. In my opinion, it's a gaffe. And then she, at the end of the book, she talks about the history behind the book. And no one mentions the gaffe in the reviews of the book. It's a very well-rated book. No one mentions it. I'm like, well, maybe she just got off because she talked like she knew what she was talking about, which she did do research, but there was kind of one thing about it that she really didn't understand, and it became a major plot point of the book. And maybe she should have understood that better. She's not perfect or anything, no one is, but no one said anything about it, whereas everyone jumped on everything in my first book. So I said, let me start putting in notes at the back of the book about things that I changed, and eventually I added a bibliography. I don't remember if there's a bibliography for book three, but there is a large one for book four, to prove that I actually did research and kind of semi maybe know what I'm talking about. If you're still here, there's one more thing that I want to mention. I'm not going to go into it a lot, but this is the first time we see the Darcy plotline involving the undefined craziness in the Darcy family, the insanity of his uncle Gregory, after whom Gregoire is named. Obviously, at first, the more important plotline is that his father slept around or slept with maids in his house, and as a result has two illegitimate children. But the Gregory plotline, it first appears here and then becomes a major part of book four, and never get and shows up again in book 10, I think. And let me just say that, first of all, there's two reasons why this plotline occurred. The first is that my interpretation of Darcy, there are kind of two camps for explaining why was Darcy such a dick at the beginning of Pride and Prejudice, and then such a nice guy at the end of Pride and Prejudice. One is the arrogant Darcy line of he is a really arrogant guy some of the time around people he doesn't know who he thinks are beneath him, and then when he gets to know people better, he realizes that he was wrong in his assumptions. I don't like that interpretation. It's a valid one, but I don't like it. It doesn't reflect well on him. The second one is that he is actually very shy, and shy Darcy is not good at social situations with people who he doesn't have anything to do with. And I've gone with that interpretation because it reflects better on him. He just screws up the Meriden Assembly in a major, major way because he's not really good at telling people what he is not thinking. He's not good at the pleasantries of life, and he doesn't really want to take part in them, and he's dragged to this assembly with by his friend and his friend's harpy sisters, one of whom wants to marry him. Who would be happy about that? And as a result, all these faux pas occur, and the rest of the book is sort of him correcting those and Elizabeth correcting hers. But I have a lot of sympathy for that Darcy because I would also, I would fucking hate an assembly, especially full of people I knew too well to want to hang out with, or people that I didn't know. I don't like dancing, probably wouldn't like the food there. It wouldn't be kosher, so I wouldn't eat it, but in principle. The whole giant social ritual of multiple hours of hanging out with people I don't want to hang out with, I don't think anyone would like, but I just have a particular dis I don't want to go really into what how I feel about things, but I've never been a very social person, and I've been in therapy in my lifetime for this. I don't have social anxiety disorder because that involves getting shortness of breath and your heart beating fast, and that never happens to me. I have something else, but I empathize a lot with that Darcy, so I've gone with that translation of That's why who he is, who isn't. I take it to an extreme. The most extreme in this book is when he basically hallucinates, though I changed it. I added the word, the line at the beginning, Darcy dreamt or something, for the chapter in which he is just full on hallucinating in that jail cell. Sensory deprivation and starvation and disease and infection have just led to him just full on having a psychotic break at that moment, seeing things that are not there. But I changed it. A lot of people couldn't understand it. No one, I think, fully understands the imagery in that scene as much as me, because I'm the one who wrote it, I'm the one who understands it, and you're not really supposed to understand it at all. I mean, it's just there's a lot of things going on in that scene, but that is him going nuts, if it isn't obvious from that scene already. But I changed it at someone's suggestion, I think it was actually Brandy's, that people wouldn't get what was going on unless he was kind of dreaming, because he was kind of dreaming. He was just awake while he was dreaming. So I put that line in, and that just cleared up the whole mess of that chapter being weird. Because otherwise, you read that chapter and you're like, what's going on? It takes you a while to figure out he's not all there at that point. And we just didn't want to confuse readers anymore. So that was a minor change I had no objection to. But he really he has two breakdowns, and one is that scene, and the other one is when he's living in Pemberley, after returning, and he's not able to function as a person. He's basically just sitting in his room and looking at the window and, in agony. And psychiatry was in its infancy. There wasn't even the word psychiatry. There were people who treated patients, but they weren't psychiatrists yet, and they basically didn't treat patients. It would come a long way, actually. The 19th century was a major advance in psychiatry. That was kind of when psychiatry took off, but that hasn't happened yet, and Darcy has no access to that. And you've got this looming shadow of his uncle also having been mad, but having been mad his whole life, pretty much, having been written out of the family as a result to save them socially. Let me just say, this is personal family business, so I'm not gonna say a lot, but let me just say that the whole Darcy and the genetic connection to a crazy uncle is something that I put in, I think, because subliminally I fully understood his anxiety there. I'm just gonna leave it at that. This is a very, very personal plot line to me. I didn't realize it when I was writing it, but I realized it when I looked back at it after I was several books in and I went back to read my earlier work. And I'm like, holy shit, I was talking about myself. I never had a breakdown or anything, but let me just say, things going on in the family, just there were some themes in that were just from my life, and I didn't realize that when I was writing them. They eventually show up in George's life, George Wickham being George Wickham the Younger, the son of the dead George Wickham. That specter returns in the form of George. The obviously hereditary family craziness, which is never defined because they didn't have definitions and because I didn't really want to define it, doesn't show up in any of the children of Darcy. It shows up in the children of Wickham, or specifically the son of Wickham, not the sister. The sister's fine. And Darcy realizes this in the fourth book, I think, that Wickham is going to go through what he went through mentally, not what happened to him in Austria, but he's going to struggle the way that Darcy is quietly struggling. Stands up and says, I understand what you're going through, and I'm going to be there for you. Partially because I killed your dad, but partially because I understand what you're going through, which is a tremendous support to George. That's in the fourth book, but it's coming. We don't know it yet, but I had that kind of planned a little bit when I wrote this plot line. Or I was definitely going to pick some kid, but I didn't think it was going to be Jeffrey because Jeffrey's a really outgoing kid. He had always been, and he's always going to be. He has Elizabeth's personality, pretty much, in terms of social life, and then he has Darcy's personality in terms of doing responsible things like being Master of Pemberley, which he eventually is, and being Master Pemberley's son, which is a very important position, and being a husband eventually. Of that, he's more of a Darcy, and in society, he's more of an Elizabeth. But George is a different story, and we see George go through some things because of the bad psychiatry at the time, makes him much worse than he would have been if people left him alone. So yeah, that happened in this book. That was just the beginning of this plot line that just rears its very ugly head from time to time, and there's kind of a resolution in George, but there's no real resolution to an ongoing issue in your life when you're not able to communicate to people the way that you feel, or you don't want to communicate to people the way that you feel because you know it's socially a bad idea to do so, or you don't think that they will understand you. I mean, there is a major break between Elizabeth and Darcy in book three that gets resolved, which is that Darcy doesn't begin to understand what has happened to him as a result of being in Austria. I keep saying Austria, it's really Romania. What has happened to him in Austria is just has left a really huge mark, and he's not able to tell Elizabeth this, and he's not really able to realize it 100% on his own. And it really takes Dr. Maddox to tell Darcy, by the way, you're really sick. Like, you are mentally ill as a result of the events of in the last couple months, and you are not able to tell other people this, and I understand that, and you're not able to tell yourself, get your shit together, because Elizabeth is really suffering and she can't reach you either. You are gone someplace where no one can reach you, and you have to come back from that. And that's a very hard place psychiatrically to be, where you are so far apart from other people. I've never been there, I don't think. I felt that way a couple times in my life, but or I've just had a problem communicating to people, but that's just like the normal thing. He just full on is not able to communicate how he feels and doesn't think there's anything wrong with how he feels. He has some idea, but he's not 100% there in terms of knowing how bad he is. And part of depression is you do not know that you are depressed unless you know the warning signs because you've been depressed before. Usually someone has to tell you, hey, are you feeling okay? Or your psychiatrist has to say, hey, you sound like you're depressed. Let's raise your Prozac. Or let's change your SSRI. Or let's lower your Klonopin or something. Usually someone else has to tell you during a major depression that you are depressed. I mean, there are some warning signs you can look for, like doesn't enjoy activities that they normally enjoy, sleeps too much or too little, cries a lot. Actually doesn't happen to a lot of people who are depressed. They're not crying an extraordinary amount. I don't cry at all when I go through periods of depression that are very, very well monitored and treated. And I tend to catch them, but they take a little while before I kind of look at myself and say, hey, I'm not feeling like myself right now. Maybe there's something that, should be changed medicinally. Maybe I'm just going through a period. I don't know. I do have chronic depression. I will say that outright. It's just a thing in my life that I was born with and shows up, and I'm medicated for it, and it shows up from time to time for no rhyme or reason. And it takes me a little while to figure it out. And sometimes I don't figure it out until it's passed. And I'm like, oh, I really wasn't doing well that month, but something changed in my life and I got better. We don't move my medication around that often. Sometimes I will recognize, huh, I seem to be hating everything right now. And all I want to do is sleep. I wonder if that's normal. Is that normal? I don't know. Because you lose your perspective of what normal is. You have no idea. Because every day of your life is going to be different anyway. People have valid emotions. People are sad for valid reasons. People are upset for valid reasons. People are angry and are anxious and all of these things that we go through in our lives for valid reasons. So when they occur because there's like a clinical depression going on where your brain's not producing enough serotonin or something, it's very hard to recognize it for what it is and say, hey, this is something bad. I should get treated for it. And this is even worse in Dar for Darcy. Let's return to the book I'm talking about. This is much worse for Darcy because psychiatrically, no one can help him. No one can say, hey, your brain's not producing enough serotonin. You should go on something that enhances that. No one can say that to him. No one can really deal. These are not like the issues that Jane Austen, when she dealt with insanity, it was more like Mrs. Bennet, who eventually does go in insane kind of because she has a bunch of strokes, but in a good way at first. But Mrs. Bennet is crazy, like in an annoying way, and today she would be treated for some kind of anxiety disorder, but most of it was just drama that bored women put on because they were really, really bored. And or they were really anxious because they were really, really bored. Jane wrote about that, but she didn't write about it in a major way. She didn't focus on it. She didn't psychiatrically understand it because it was her life and because there wasn't terms for it and there weren't treatments for it. But people did tend to get sick in Regency England of nervous disorders when they were extremely bored. Sometimes they were legitimate and sometimes they were faked to get attention because they were so bored. Women faking, feigning spells, and all of that was kind of passed off as common and socially acceptable. It was a way to be sick in a socially acceptable manner. It was kind of a rich person's disease, like gout, except gout is real. Gout really does exist, and you can get it from eating too much meat, drinking too much wine, and not exercising enough. It's also hereditary somewhat. But, nervous diseases that people got at the time, they were mainly women, and they were mainly really bored, rich women. On the other hand, like when I think about how bored I would be in the Regency period, I probably would have gone nuts too, just for the sake of having something to do. Because going nuts gives you things to do. Worrying about the wallpaper attacking you or something is something to do. People ask me sometimes, this is one of the common questions I get asked as a Regency author, is if you could go back into what Jane Austen book, what would you go into? And I'm like, none of them. They all sound like horrible places to be. Oh my God, I would be so bored. There wouldn't be enough books in the world for me to read, for me to be less bored. I mean, yeah, there were books, but you can only read so many books in a day. My limit is four. And then I would be so bored. I mean, these dinners went on for hours, and you had to go to these assemblies, and the dances were 15 minutes long, which is 14 and a half minutes too long for me to dance. Oh my God, just walking, like, walking, that was their major activity of the day. Let's take a fucking walk. Oh my God, just I would hate living in Regency England. I don't care what Jane Austen book you would put me into. I don't care if I would end up marrying Mr. Darcy. I don't want to be in Regency England as a rich person because I'll be bored, and as a poor person because I'll have to work all of my life for slave wages and then die of a disease that's not preventable because they have no antibiotics. Just, no. Terrible time period to live. Also, they have no plumbing. And I mean, they had some plumbing. The flush toilet, though, was not very widespread. I think it had been invented by this time, but it just wasn't in major use. By the end of the series, I do mention that they put in, plumbing, and they're so excited about water closets. But oh my God, not living with flush toilets, just forget it, man. I am not there at all. I don't care if there's Mr. Darcy and he's Jewish. And he has an adorable beard, and because some guys look adorable with beards, and he really cares about role-playing games, and he loves Tibetan culture, and he's a rab. I don't care how perfect you make him. If you put Darcy in the Regency period, I do not want to be there. I don't want to be in that time period. Oh, and everyone smelled bad. Just I could go on and on. So I hated that question. I get that question a lot, and I'm just like, no, none of them, because they don't produce pills in that time period, and I have stomach problems, and I need pills. Like, if I could bring the pills with me, like a lifetime supply of Imodium and Zantac, then yes, I would maybe think about going, but then I wouldn't because they don't have toilets, and they don't have Purell, and they smell bad, and they're bored. Just there's no reason to go, just none whatsoever. Oh my God, I'd go for like a day. A day trip. Not even overnight. I wouldn't even do overnight. I would definitely like go in the morning and leave in the evening. And man, I've gone off topic. I hope that people are, if you're still listening, I hope that you're doing something at the same time as you're listening to this. Like, right, sometimes I'm surfing the internet or watching something or listening to something. I'm usually drawing or something like that. But okay, so I need to cut this down. Thanks for listening, by the way. I just had a lot to say about this book and the way it made me feel. And the next one will be shorter, unless I have some rant to go off on and people enjoy that. If you enjoyed this long rant about my personal life and my various medical problems, please let me know and I will continue to do it. Because honestly, if people want to hear about this shit, then, fine. I criticized people in my first podcast for blogging about their personal lives. But if you want to hear it, I'll let you know. But you have to want to hear it. Okay, so just, let me know how you feel about that. Anyway, book three. If you haven't read it yet, man, you should be confused at this point. Go read it. Buy the book, preferably, or read it online. I don't care. Just go and read it and enjoy. And I'll be back with book four, which is The Ballad of Gregoire Darcy, published by Ulysses Press, which was released in May. That will be it for my. No, actually, I have the short stories to also discuss in a podcast. And hopefully, I will have a podcast for book five in the next year. And I'll come up with other shit about Pride and Prejudice to talk about, I'm sure. So, thanks for listening.